Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. This is Irene Watson. I'm managing editor of Reader Views in Austin, Texas.
And I'm Victor Volkman from Loving Healing Press in Ann Arbor, Michigan. You can hear our show every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Today's topic is successful writing in the children's market. And our special guest who will be joining us this hour is Dr. Lila Guzman of LilaGuzman.com. You can hear more about our guest on the Authors Access website, which is www.authorsaccess.com. Now, before we get started this evening, I would like to remind all our listeners that Reader Views and Loving Healing Press are sponsoring a short story writing contest. Send us your true story of a transformational event in your life, and it could appear on our upcoming anthology of stories. Remember, you have just one more week to enter our contest. For more details, go to readerviews.com and click on Literary Contest on the far right sidebar. Also, starting the week of February 19th, our podcast will be heard on a new radio station, authorsview.com. Please check our website for updates. Now, tonight we'll be speaking with award-winning children's book author Lila Guzman of LilaGuzman.com. She'll be sharing her valuable tips and techniques on how to break into this popular market, including things such as the ideal length of a book, managing the vocabulary, plot tips and twists, characters, both human, animal, and otherwise, and historical books, a particular area of her own success. Now, Lila is a former language instructor who earned her Ph.D. in Spanish literature from the University of Kentucky. She's gone on to teach at the U.S. Navy's Defense Language Institute to train other teachers there. She has collaborated with her husband, Rick Guzman, to create a groundbreaking series of historical novels for children. It all stems from Rick's discovery that the Spanish were involved in the American Revolutionary War as early as 1776, and their contribution is usually overlooked in most history books. And so the award-winning Lorenzo series of books was born. And now we're going to go to this week's special guest, Lila Guzman. Good evening to you, Lila.
Hi, Victor. How are you? Hi, Irene.
Hi, Lila.
The topic for tonight is writing for children versus writing for adults. And a lot of times people think that it is a lot easier to write for children, and nothing could really be further from the truth. And that's one of the main misconceptions about writing for children. People will look at the size of children's books, picture books, or chapter books, and they think, oh, that's easy, I can do that. And we jokingly say that our motto is, it's so simple, even a caveman can do it, to steal from some insurance company. And it's not as easy as it looks, because you have to condense a lot of material into a very, very short, very short words. But the hardest thing, really, about writing for children is that you're writing for adults first. You have to get past an adult editor. You have to get past adult librarians, adult teachers, before you actually get your book into the hands of your target audience, the children.
Well, you just said something just very important, Lila, that you have to write first for the adult to get it into the publishing circle, but with the intent of the children reading. You know,
exactly.
I never gave that any thought at all. And so, gosh, that's really difficult. Just give us a little more on that, because that's totally interesting.
Well, a lot of times people think that the book goes directly to the child's hands, but we also have book reviewers, and you have to get a good book review or else your book is going to be sunk. So, yeah, you have to write with the children in mind, but you also have to think about what the market is like nowadays, and you have to tailor things to what the market is going to be able to carry.
So are there trends in children's writing?
Are there what, please?
Trends. Are there certain trends or themes that are popular at certain times and not at others? Or, you know, right now for adults, it seems like if there's a little romance in the story, it makes it. Where is there such a thing going on for children's books,
too?
There
are certain things that are always hot with children. Children love horror. They love anything that's bloody and gory. One of the hardest things to place with children's writing are historicals, because children don't like the historicals nearly as much as the adult librarians do. They like the teaching value of the historical. But there are certain things that are always hot. Vampires. Seems like in children's literature, we're constantly having vampires come back. Darren Shan has got a whole series of vampire books. Stephanie Myers just recently has been very successful with her her vampire series. The first one is Twilight. So there are certain things that are always there that they like. Kids like to read about characters that are slightly older than they are. So they're intrigued with the contemporary novels about things that are happening right now in schools, things like steroids, cheerleaders, things of that nature for the upper group.
So what is it that, you know, and I noticed that too, that we are getting on more and more kids that are reviewing kids' books, which I think in the end that's really who needs to be doing the reviews, except I guess at the publishing stage. And this is what I've noticed, that they're interested in the horrors, the mystery, like you say, the bloody, the fantasy, the science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So where does this trend come from? What is it, what's possessing these kids to be interested in something that probably us adults are not interested in?
I think there's just something in it, basically that intrigues children about elves, witches, warlocks, the magical, anything of that nature. In fact, the first thing that I published was Green Slime and Jam, which was a contemporary fantasy about characters that are hit with slime, and when it hits their character in their picture in a book, they're pulled out of the book and they wind up being 5 inches tall, and they have to figure how they got out of their book and how they can get back in. So fantasy, science fiction sort of sells, but fantasy in particular. Look at how popular Harry Potter is.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And Harry Potter, I'm not dissing the author, but a wizard is not new. Go back to The Wizard of Oz. You know, there are just certain things that children just love to read about.
So is there a difference between the genres for kids as there is for adults? Do
not
they have the
really.
Same? No.
The only thing that doesn't translate for children's literature is erotica. Anything pornographic or erotic doesn't belong in a children's book. And, in fact, that's one reason I like to write for children, is that there are no sex scenes. Sometimes we have contemporary young adult literature that does have sex scenes, shower scenes, things of that nature, but that's not the type of thing that I write. So you have to steer away from anything sexual. And for the younger kids, they're not interested in that in the first place. And anything too terribly violent also. You can get bloody to a certain point, and then you can cross the line where it's really not good for children.
So in the fiction and versus nonfiction in the children's market, so what I'm hearing then is probably there's more, the kids want more fiction rather than nonfiction, because you were mentioning that it's hard to write. The kids are not interested in historical, but what we're just talking about, the fantasy and the horror and so on, is more of the fiction. Could you take us a little further into that area?
That's kind of the oddity of writing for children, is that the fiction market is not where you're going to make the most money. The money in the children's market is really in the nonfiction. I write fiction and nonfiction. And I actually like the fiction better, because you've got more freedom to move. When you write nonfiction, if you're writing a biography, you're pretty well stuck with whatever that person did in their life. But the nonfiction market is enormous. And if somebody wants to break into children's writing, nonfiction is probably the easiest and the best way to go. We're constantly needing new nonfiction books for children. We now need books on all of the presidential candidates. Those are things that the children are going to be interested in. In 2008, whatever administration comes in, we're going to need biographies on who the new Secretary of State is, who the, whoever, the Attorney General. All of those things need to be written. So there's a tremendous need for nonfiction for children. And they're pretty lucrative, too, as far as the contracts go. For fiction, it's a harder market, but the irony here again is when you make it in fiction, you make it big, because the Harry Potter author is richer than the Queen of England. So,
that's for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they recently did a tracking of who the most who the richest people were in the entertainment business, and Oprah Winfrey was number one, and the author of Harry Potter was number two. So we do sometimes make it. One of the advantages of writing for children is that our books actually have a longer shelf life. If you're writing for adults, you've got maybe 3-4 months of promotion, and then the publishing company is going to be ready to move on to whatever their next thing is. But with children, the publishing companies, the promoters, they understand that you lose your audience for 3 months, for the summer months, when they're gone from school. So we have a longer shelf life. We have more of a chance for our book to actually catch fire with the kids.
Yes, I'm wondering, how important are awards in the children's market, and how do you know which are the awards you should be spending your time and money going after?
If you could get a Newbery or a Caldecott, your success is guaranteed. They're highly competitive on that level. There's a lot of lesser awards that are still perfectly good awards. The Writers League of Texas has a $1,000 award called a Teddy Award that they give out for young adult fiction, and then they also give out another $1,000 for a slightly younger crowd. And that brings up something I really should point out, too, is that there are so many divisions in children's literature that it's easy to carve out a niche for yourself. You can either go the picture book route, and some people have had very successful careers in that, or you can do chapter books, which is more for like the first, second, third, fourth grade area. Or you can do young adult. And young adult is usually 11, 12, 13, 14. When you get past 14 years old, they're ready to graduate to adult writers. So usually our market ends about 14 years old.
Right. Let me ask you another question while we're talking about the different divisions of children's literature. How do you figure out the price points for these things, like a picture book versus a chapter book and young adult?
You know, honestly, I don't. My publisher is the one who sticks the barcode on there and decides.
Sure.
And that always is kind of a mystery to me, because a picture book usually will run about $16.
Oh, my goodness.
And, yeah, that seems like, to me, that seems like a big chunk of change. A young adult book will usually be in hardcover about $13, and then when it goes into paperback, it might be $9 or $10. But the publisher and not the author is the one who actually decides what price they think they can put on a book and actually get for a book.
Sure, that makes sense.
And there's something about the size also that has something to do with it. And with the picture books, they're having to pay for color illustrations, and I think that's part of what increases the price of a picture book.
Yeah, I believe it's more labor intensive to get the color exactly right, and then often they'll go to Asia to get it printed. And
I've heard that
money.
A lot, that Hong Kong is one of the big places to get picture books done.
Now, if I'm just trying to break into the market, do I need an agent, or how do I figure out, you know, what makes a dynamite proposal?
That's one of the great things about writing for children. The market has tightened up so much for adult authors that to get into the big houses, Random House, Simon & Schuster, you really have to have an agent. It used to be they would take things that just kind of came over the transom, but not anymore.
Oh.
But children's books still have that unagented avenue that you can go. I don't have an agent, and I'm up on my 13th book now. So, you know, I'm doing perfectly fine without an agent. An agent will get you into the Hollywood market. And if you want to sell to Hollywood, it's a good idea to have the agent. Or for foreign rights, it's really good to have an agent. But I'm chugging along just fine without one. Now, if somebody wants to represent me, that's fine. But in the children's market, it's not absolutely essential to have one, as it is in the adult market.
Great. Now, if I'm getting started, where can I get feedback from other people? I mean, because I'll ask my family and friends, and they'll say, oh, that's a wonderful book, but I really need, you know, concrete suggestions on plot and characters and dialogue.
Mm-hmm. The problem with family is that if I try to get advice from my family members, they actually have to eat my food, so they can't really, you know, tell me exactly what they think. I have a critique group that meets down at the Barnes & Noble every Tuesday from 7 until sometimes they kick us out of the Barnes & Noble.
And this is in Austin.
That's in Austin.
Yeah, okay.
And the Barnes & Noble very graciously allows us to sit there for hour after hour. And what we do is we share chapters with each other. We give each other a chapter of whatever we're working on, and we take it home, and we read it, we think about it, and we write, we hope, intelligent comments about the chapter. And so a critique group, in my opinion, is the best thing that you can have, because they will give you honest feedback. One of my critique partners is a fifth-grade teacher, so she's great to have to hear feedback, because she's right there basically in the trenches. We met as a result of the SCBWI chapter here in Austin, and that's the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. And everyone who's interested in writing for children really should be a member of the SCBWI. And that's a national and an international organization, so anywhere just about in the United States, you can find a local chapter. And they're supportive. You'll meet people that you'll want to have in your critique group. You'll meet published writers. You'll meet unpublished writers. And it's just a wonderful organization. But I think the feedback is absolutely essential. There have been so many times that my critique group has said, now, wait a second, on page 3, she was doing such and such. Well, why is she doing, you know, this on page 5? So they catch me doing things that it becomes invisible after a while. You really have to have a critique checking behind you.
And I'd like to remind people that you're listening to Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. Today's topic is successful writing in the children's market, and our special guest this hour is Lila Guzman. Authors Access is a joint production of Reader Views Incorporated and Loving Healing Press. Starting the week of February 19th, our podcast will be heard on a new radio station, authorviews.com. Please check our website for updates.
Lila, you were talking about the books and the topics and the genres, I guess. And so now I'd like to talk a little bit about the content and possibly what type of content is necessary for each age group. Can you just expand on that a little for us?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. I don't write picture books, your average picture book like Polar Express. The picture books that I have coming out are nonfiction. So the content there is pretty well determined by the person's life. If you're going to write a chapter book or a young adult novel, if you're going to write fiction, there are certain, I hate to use the word rules, but that's the best thing that comes to mind. There are certain things you should or should not do in a children's book. In a children's book, a lot of times we kill off the parents. And I know that sounds kind of violent, but we get them out of the way somehow. That's why a lot of children's books have the main character being an orphan, like Harry Potter. You know, he's living with his aunt and uncle. The reason that we do that is that in a children's book, you want the child to have a problem that the child faces and the child tries to solve, but the child needs to solve the problem him or herself. If the adult is there, then it's real easy for the child to go to the adult and say, you know, what should I do? Or the adult will intrude into the story. So we want the child to do as much on their own to be proactive. And not have a simple solution to their problem. One other thing that we like to do is we try to avoid being really being condescending. Children are not idiots, so you don't want to write down to them. You have to keep the plot simple, but you want to have very frequent hooks or cliffhangers, something that keeps that child turning the page. We've gotten to a place in our society where books are in competition with Nintendos, with all sorts of video games, computer games, everything under the sun. And so we have to keep the plot simple, keep it moving very quickly, and do it in a way that it's not confusing to a child. In adult novels, a lot of times you'll see flashbacks. Flashbacks can be very confusing to a child, so you have to be very careful that the child understands it's a flashback and that the flashback is over and we're back to the present time. I mentioned earlier, I think, that they like to read about children that are slightly older than they are. So if you're writing a book that has the main character that's 13 years old, that's probably going to be read by 9, 10, 11-year-olds. The two things that you need to be careful about if you're writing for children is violence and sex. And since my husband and I write about the American Revolution, the violence part is kind of hard to tone down. We write about war and ugly things happen during war. So we try to do as much with the child in mind as we possibly can. With sex, they're generally not interested in sex. When you get to the upper level young adult novels, yes, they are. But mostly you try to eliminate anything graphic from the novel.
So what I'm hearing you say, Lila, then, is really the books need to have some type of an underlying theme, something that the kids can read and, as you say, solve, be proactive in it.
Go ahead. Oh, well, what I was going to say was, we always try to put a moral or a lesson in the book, but it's not obvious. I mean, we want the child at the end to say, wow, Lorenzo had a lot of problems that he had to solve, and he did the right thing even when doing the wrong thing would have been the easy thing to do. So you want a moral, or you want the child to walk away with something. Now, some books are just for fun. There's no moral in them. But you want the child usually to learn something and to feel like they are a better person, or that they're walking away with a lesson without them knowing they're walking away with a lesson. Keechee and Jungle Jeopardy, the my most recent novel that came out, is about respecting the environment, that you're only supposed to use the things that you need to use out of the jungle or the desert or, you know, whatever environment you live in. And so I tried to do that in a way where it's not preaching to the kids, because one of the first things that will turn a child off is if they think they're being preached to. So you have to let them see the lesson through the eyes of the protagonist.
So what about the length of a book? How many pages do you suggest, let's say, for a young adult or a teen?
Wow, that's a great question. It used to be that we were told to keep the book at about 40,000 words if it's a young adult novel. And that would be a manuscript of about 200 double-spaced pages. Now, with Harry Potter, Inkheart, Aragon, the Rick Riordan series, The Lightning Thief, some young adult novels and middle grade novels are getting to where they are just huge. So I think the sky is kind of the limit anymore on young adult novels. I'm not as concerned about word length or word count or the length of the novel as I used to be. And Harry Potter, I think, is the main thing that we have to thank for the gigantic novels that are out there now.
So
picture books are about 2,000 words. Sometimes you will have definite word counts where if you go onto a website or if you look at an editor's guidelines, they will say no more than 25,000 words. And if they give you a definite word length, you really should try to keep it at that and cut it off at the 25,000.
What about chapter books? Should there be just a limited amount of chapters?
A chapter book really is the first time a child moves into a book that's big enough to be divided up into chapters. We've got a new type of book also called a tween book.
Uh-huh.
We used to have middle grade, and then children would go into young adults, and now we have something called tween, which is kind of that awkward 10, 11, 12-year-old age where they're not really ready for the more mature subject matter that can be in the young adult. But yet they're too big for the littler books, the ones that might have, let's say, a dog as the main character. So those are the tween books, and that's getting to be something popular And I haven't gone into that yet. Not, that's one of those things I want to investigate later on.
I was talking to an author just, within the last couple of weeks, Lila, and he has written some books, and they're mainly for boys. And he actually told me that he has 27 manuscripts, and he is having a hard time getting a publisher to be even interested because the theme is for boys, and he's trying to capture the attention of tweeners.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you have any comments on that as to why are they not interested in publishing books for boys?
Well, actually, they should be. Mm-hmm. There is a standard joke in the children's industry that boys don't read, that girls will read boy books, but boys will not read girl books. And our publisher for the Lorenzo series has told us, keep writing those action adventure for boys, because I'm not really meaning to diss boys, but you've got to get their attention, you've got to hold their attention, and things have to move very rapidly. And I have three children, and my middle child is a boy, and when he was about 10 years old, it was torture for him to read. And one time he picked up a book called Jimmy Spoon and the Pony Express, and he read that and he put it down. He said, wow, that was a really good book. Well, the book had barely hit the table before I snatched it up and started reading it, thinking, what was it that attracted him? And the chapters were about 3 pages each, and at the end of every chapter, there was some sort of hook there that you had to read on. You had to find out what the next adventure was. And it was just action, 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 action. So for the person that's got the manuscripts there and is having no luck, he might want to go back and see, you know, if he put in a hook at the end of every chapter so they have to read on, and is it just drenched with action? Because that's what boys really want. Their attention span has to be kept by that constant action, that constant drumbeat.
Right. Lila, let's talk a little bit more about managing the vocabulary and keeping the words within a child's understanding. Is it better to try and, you know, stretch the vocabulary a little, or how do you gauge it to get it just right?
When I write, I honestly do not think about the vocabulary while I'm writing.
Oh.
As I'll just write it as the way that I think the story needs to be told. When I'm going back and I'm doing the editing process, that's when I might find a big word like consternation. And I might think to myself, do I really want to use that word? And I might then go to my thesaurus and find something that's a little bit better. But one reason I'm not real tight about the vocabulary is in historicals, there are lots of words that come up that the kids are going to have to catch in context. If you're talking about a blacksmith, mm-hmm. you know, maybe they anymore don't know what a blacksmith is. But if they read the paragraph and they read about the blacksmith as sweating as he bent over the anvil and pounded on the horseshoe or whatever he's doing, then they can pick up what the job is that the blacksmith does. Some writers are very conscious of of who they're writing to, and they have a lot of control as they're writing over the vocabulary. That's really, I think, what an editor is for. You know, once in a while they'll catch a word of mine and say, well, you know, is there something that you can use that's a little bit smaller? But that's really a problem I don't have too much of a problem with. I think part of it is that I have three children, and I'm constantly aware of what's in their vocabulary and what's not. And having children, to me, is a great boon to writing for young adults and for children, because I keep up with what the latest expressions are. And sometimes my children will tell me, oh, Mom, no, that is so old school. Nobody's saying that anymore. And so I've changed my vocabulary, you know, and I listen to whatever the latest terms are that they're bringing home.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. In terms of keeping up with the kids, I mean, I'm sure now they all have iPods and cell phones and Nintendos. How do you work technology into a children's story?
Well, that's one of the beauties about writing historicals is I don't have to with the historicals, but with Green Slime and Jam, the very first novel that I did, there was some internet technology in there, and that book was published in 2001.
Oh.
And when I go back and I read that book, I think to myself, okay, you know, there's some things that aren't exactly accurate now, that if I was to edit the book and to do another version of it, I would update the technology a little bit. But the technology is a problem, especially with science fiction. Things are moving so quickly that it's hard to keep up with something and to keep it from sounding like it's old. I just finished reading an adult science fiction that was set in 1959, and the technology there sometimes makes you chuckle because the way they start cars, you know, the way the main character was doing that wasn't the way they're doing it now. So with technology, you have to be very, very aware of what the kids are going to be familiar with. You need to know instant messaging. You need to know that C, capital U, L, the number 8, and ER is see you later, you know, and all those things they're using on instant messaging. But that is kind of a sticky problem, is that technology is moving so quickly it's hard to keep up with it. And every child now has a cell phone, just about. So if you're writing a young adult and your child does not have a cell phone, that's telegraphing a certain message to the reader that the child may come from a certain socioeconomic level and they can't afford a cell phone, or they're out in the boondocks where they're not going to get a cell phone signal or whatever. So you have to take a lot of this technology into account.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point you've raised there. Now, I think the conventional wisdom is, you know, the way to be successful is to develop a series. And can you share with us some things that you've learned in terms of developing this?
When my husband and I started out writing the Lorenzo series, we really didn't, well, we did intend for it to be a series, but the first one had to be successful for the publisher then to be interested in picking up book number 2, book number 3, and so forth. The beauty about a series is that you get your audience, and the children look forward to the next one coming out in the series. As a writer, the easy thing about a series is once I know the personality of Lorenzo and his girlfriend Eugenie and Galvez and all the people that he comes into contact with, then book number 2 is easy to write because I'm concentrating then on the plot and I know the characters. They're like family to me at that point. A series is a great way to get started, and Rick Riordan is having a lot of success with the new series that he's got out, the Lightning Thief being the first book, and then look at what Harry Potter has done. You know, kids love series. They love to feel like they know the characters, and then for the writer, if they accidentally pick up book number 3 and read it, then they want to read book number 1 and number 2 to see what happens. So your book sales increase by having the series also.
Right. In terms of writing a lot of books, let's talk about multiple markets. If I'm going to cross over into different genres, should I really think about getting a pen name, or how do you manage working in different genres?
I use the same name as long as it's a children's novel, whether it's children's or young adult. I always use Lila Guzman, but if I were to go over into the adult line, I might decide that I want to use a pen name there. Rick Riordan started out writing adult mysteries, and he was highly successful in that. He wrote, he won the Edgar and several of the big mystery writers' awards, and then he went into children's writing, and when he sent off his query letter to the agent, he used a fake name because he had already established himself as an adult. Once the books got published, they decided that he already had name recognition and to stick with that name. I think using a pen name is perfectly fine. Anne Rice uses a different names according to whether she's doing her vampire novels or she's doing some other type of thing. So someday, if I ever do write an adult level, I probably will decide to use a different name. Although the good thing about writing for children is your children grow up, they have children, and you have a brand new audience.
That's right. I hadn't thought about that. And older siblings pass it down to younger siblings,
mm-hmm.
and so on. Now, given that there's almost every publisher has a children's division, how in the world do you go about targeting the right publisher that's going to fit your style?
Well, that's a great question. When we finished Lorenzo, Lorenzo's secret mission went to agents and publishers up in New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, and we went about 6 months with absolutely no success. We would get great rejection letters, which doesn't really help you along the publishing path except to tell you, you know, your writing is okay. We would get rejection letters that would say, this is an interesting story and it's beautifully written, but we don't know how to market it. Uh-huh. And so after 6 months of rejections, my husband says, well, why don't we go to a Texas publisher? And I kind of looked at him strangely and I thought, well, I don't know about this. And so we sent off to two publishers. Lorenzo is from San Antonio. And so we had a Texas-specific or a Louisiana-specific story. And we sent off to two publishers, and within a week we had letters from both publishers saying, please send us the entire manuscript. So we sent it in, and nothing happens quickly in the publishing industry. We waited about 3 months. And we got offers from both of the publishing companies. So then we were able to pick which contract had the best terms, which one had the best advance, and so forth. So what we learned was you really have to sell and you have to explain to the publisher why this book is really going to hit and what's the importance of the book. And I feel like that when we initially did the sending of Lorenzo to New York City, that we didn't make it clear what the niche was. And in hindsight, which is always, you know, 2020, in hindsight we saw that we kind of shot ourselves in the foot by not saying there are 850,000 Hispanic eighth graders in the United States. And this book should be in every American history classroom because it covers an aspect of American history that's not in their history book.
Right.
The main thing is you have to find that publisher who gets it, who's willing to put the money behind because it's they're putting a lot on the line there when they decide to publish your book. And the publisher really needs to fall in love with your book. For Keechee and Jungle Jeopardy, when I sent that book in, The publisher had actually asked me for a different manuscript that she knew I was working on, but that manuscript wasn't finished. So I was kind of in a funny mood, and I just thought, well, Keechee is done. I'm going to send Keechee in. And she started reading it, and she told me later, she said, I got down to the second paragraph, and I thought, what happened to that novel that I asked for? And then by the time she got to the third paragraph, she was intrigued enough that she thought, yeah, this worked. So sometimes it's just kismet. It's just making the publisher be convinced that this novel is unique, kids are going to love it, and you're going to make them a lot of money. Because as much as I love writing, the bottom line is how much money are you going to make for the publisher?
Right, absolutely. Now let's talk about probably the scariest thing I've ever heard of, which is self-publishing a children's book. I know you haven't done this directly yourself, but you've probably met people who have. Do you have any specific advice along that line?
I kind of go off the reservation with self-publishing. What I usually tell people is that if your book is good enough, it will eventually be picked up by a publisher. You may not get published by Random House. It might not be Simon & Schuster. You may have to go with a small press. But I'm too scared to self-publish. Because if you self-publish, you have to know every aspect of the publishing industry. You're doing everything pretty much yourself. You're promoting, you're getting it out there on Amazon.com, and I don't have faith enough in myself knowing all the stuff that I need to know to self-publish. And I need the advice of going to the publisher and saying, well, you know, what should we do now? Or how do we get this into zoos? Or how do we get this book into another venue? You know, how do I get this out to Chihuahua clubs in the United States? So I really am not a big, big fan of self-publishing. I know that the publishing industry misses a lot of things. There are things like, I think, the Celestine Prophecy that was self-published first.
Right.
Aragon by Christopher Paolini was self-published, and it was picked up by a major publishing company. So it can be done. It's just that it's such a hard, hard route to go. that somebody really has to be out there. Paolini and his parents were out there every weekend with their station wagon filled with books, and they were promoting every single weekend. So you have to, if you're going to self-publish, you've got to be in it for the long haul, and you've got to have a lot of energy and a lot of connections, and it's the perfect thing for some people.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on those points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's perfect for some people, and it's the ideal way to go. And then for other people, maybe there's a better way to do it.
Yeah, what kind of media and publicity opportunities are there for an author of children's books? I know, with nonfiction, you sort of get on the radio shows as an expert and eventually work your way up into the TV market if you're persistent. But what kind of coverage can you expect to get?
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that's something I should have said earlier. We children's writers are lucky because we have a captive audience. We know exactly where our readers are 9 to 10 months out of the year. They're sitting in classrooms. One of our best ways of selling books is to pick up the phone, to dial librarians, and just do an introductory thing of I'm so-and-so, I've written such-and-such children's book. Are you interested in an author visit? And librarians have money so that they can pay us to come in and talk to the children. I love to talk to children and to tell them about writing and to ask them questions and to get their feedback. But one of my biggest sources of income is doing author visits in schools. And March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, I'm going to be going down to the valley. Here in Texas, we have the valley runs along the Rio Grande. And I'm going to be going into schools, visiting, and I'm going to be getting paid for what I like to do best, which is talk to children. So we have a venue there that the adult authors don't have. And you can make, back to the chunk of change, you can make a chunk of change during the year doing author visits. You get paid for the visit, and then you sell books on top of that.
Yeah, that's great. I've heard even some libraries have budgets to pay authors to come in.
Right, uh-huh. One of the worst things I've found recently is bookstores. It's very hard to get a book signing if you're a children's author, unless you're a huge name. It's hard to get a signing in a bookstore because that's not our best venue. The average number of books sold in a bookstore is 3 in 2 hours. Well, put me in a school where I'm going to meet class after class after class, and I can talk to them about the American Revolution, or I can talk about little chihuahuas getting lost in the Mayan jungle. I can see a whole lot more kids in one day there than any other possible venue for us.
Yeah, that sounds just about perfect. I'd like to close our discussion with a sample reading from your new book, Keechee.
All right. Keechee and Jungle Jeopardy is about a chihuahua that gets lost in the jungle during ancient Mayan times. And at one point in the book, Keechee is captured by some evil monkeys. So I'm going to start reading on chapter 5. "A chihuahua," the boa said, her eyes glittering in anger. "What's he doing here?" She lapped her coils around Copal. Copal is a monkey. "You're strangling me, babe." "No, this is strangling." She tightened the coils. "Relax, babe, you're getting all uptight." The coils tightened a bit more. "I get uptight when someone betrays me. Having a dog here means you're secretly working with humans." "Aw, come on, babe," the monkey choked out. "You know me better than that. I kidnapped him. He's part of my plan to start a war between the humans. Once they're gone, the jungle will be ours again." His voice turned velvety. "And we will rule it together, babe, just you and me." The coils loosened. Her gaze softened. "I rolled my eyes. How disappointing. I thought snakes were smarter than that. Imagine her swallowing that line." But then again, snakes swallowed lots of things. Rabbits, rats, and little dogs like me. I definitely needed to keep a sharp eye on her. Suddenly, the air was filled with the sound of hundreds of wings beating together. Copal jerked his head around. "Run! It's a raid!" He grabbed a vine and swung away. An army of parrots, dragonflies, and butterflies swooped toward the platform. Some landed in nearby trees, some perched on branches, still others fluttered onto the treehouse itself. a large spotted jaguar, accompanied by several smaller black ones, jumped into the center of the treehouse. A toucan sat down beside him. "The orchids are secured," a dragonfly announced from a distant tree. "They are unharmed." "Good work, Air Force," the jaguar said. A big blue butterfly flew in and hovered in front of him. "The trees are empty. They've fled. All clear except for a snake and a dog." She spoke in a honeyed voice. All butterflies have kind, soft voices, but hers was particularly sweet. "Go after Kopal and his gang," the jaguar ordered. Parrots, dragonflies, and butterflies obeyed without question. Squinting, the toucan turned toward Babe the boa. "We've got the goods on you two. When we catch Kopal, he's going away for a long time." She sat in a clump of coils, watching with cold disinterest. "I don't know a thing. My hands are clean." "Madam," the toucan said, "you don't have hands." He turned toward me. "I must say I'm surprised to see you here, Sonny. You and the snake make an unlikely pair." All at once, I recognized the bird. "You're the toucan I met earlier." "That is correct. Would you explain to me how a chihuahua manages to climb a tree?" "I didn't. I was walking through the jungle when a monkey grabbed me and whisked me up here." The jaguar frowned at me. "I knew they were kidnapping orchids. I didn't know they'd work their way up to dogs." And that's not the end of the chapter, but that's probably a good place.
Okay, now you've got me hooked. I want the book. That is great. Oh, gosh, Lila, thank you so much for being our guest on this session. You know, you have just so much information that I know that our listeners are just going to be amazed with what they have learned tonight.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, definitely we'll have you back again. And tell us again your website.
It's www.lilaguzman.com. And if you just Google LILAGUZMAN, it should pop up as the first thing on a Google search.
Well, this is great. And just tell us again, how many books have you authored?
13. I've got one coming out soon on Mohammed that's a picture book. Lorenzo and the Pirate is coming out in 2008. So we also are doing a book on George Lopez. We already have one biography of him, and the publisher asked us to do a biography for 8 through 12-year-olds since we already have the 4 through 8-year-olds covered. So he's a lot of fun to write about, a wonderful person, and so much information there that it's a good life for the children to read about and to imitate the struggles and the things he's overcome.
Mm-hmm. And in your Lorenzo series, how many books do you have?
We've got 3 out right now, and Lorenzo and the Pirate's going to be number 4.
And is this going to be a continuation of series in the Lorenzo series?
He's eventually going to get to Yorktown in 1783, but we still have to get him to the Battle of Mobile, the Battle of Pensacola. He has many, many, many more adventures in him.
Ah, great. So this is going to be a long series then.
It is.
Great.
We eventually are going to get him to Hawaii also. We found out there was a Spanish connection to Hawaii. The King of Spain sent some cowboys over to Hawaii to start the cattle industry. So that's a future novel.
Well,
there are so many things out there that need to be written.
Oh, no kidding. Well, I just have to smile when you're talking about going to Hawaii because I also do genealogy. And just during my family research, of course, the American Revolution has come up and going to Hawaii. So isn't that great?
Uh-huh.
Well, thanks again, Lila, and we really, really do appreciate you sharing all this information with us. And
thank you.
We're just happy that you have been with us.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to another podcast edition of Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. You can hear us every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and we'll be back on the air Thursday, February 1st, 2007, when our topic will be Breaking Out of the Bookstore, and our special guest who will be joining us is Shel Horowitz of frugalmarketing.com. You can learn more about our guests on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. Authors Access is a joint production of Reader Views and Loving Healing Press.
And for Reader Views, this is Irene Watson of Austin, Texas, signing off.
For Loving Healing Press, this is Victor Volkman in frozen Ann Arbor, Michigan, wishing you all a good evening.